This is John Havelock on KFRB Radio Beeline Show in Fairbanks, March 25th, 1974. Havelock plans to announce for the U.S. House this week, Thursday probably in Anchorage.
That two persons are known to be in. State Senator Willie Hensley, Democrat of Kotzebue, has said that he'll declare his candidacy when the session adjourns, possibly 3 weeks from now. And of course, incumbent Congressman Don Young, Republican of Fairbanks, will undoubtedly run again. If you enter that race, would you have, you know, just speculating now, would you anticipate that that's the entire field?
Yes.
I would, too.
Yes, I don't know. I keep my ears open, needless to say, and there are any of the people that have been talked about as possible candidates I've checked out, and there do not appear to be any other candidates.
If you decide to announce Thursday for the U.S. House, what kind of primary campaign would you envisage?
Well, as far as the primary campaign goes, Larry, Willie Hensley and I have been friends for over at least 10 years, and I don't see any reason why this campaign should, if I enter, would disturb that friendship at all. We're interested in good representation in Washington, and I think that both of us would, each of us would view the other as a better representative than the incumbent, and I think that if Willie runs, he's going to be running against Don Young, and if I run, I'll be running against Don Young, too.
Possibly not entirely. About a month ago, maybe it was 2 months ago, State Senator Willie Hensley was here on this show talking about his candidacy, and he talked a little bit about you, and he mentioned that semantic albatross that some have hung on you, that you don't, he says, talk the average guy's language. What if he tosses that up during the campaign? Well, he has. And what are you going to do with that one?
Well, I don't know, Larry. I mean, I am who I am, and I talk the way I talk. And if that's unsatisfactory, then I suppose I won't be elected. It isn't going to... I don't really have any response to it. I feel that however I talk, that on a emotional level and on a philosophical level, I am for, my heart is with the working man primarily, and I see that as the primary representation. The fact that, I'm a professional advocate, and the language that you use in the Congress is not the language you use in the street. The language of the legislature, of statute drafting, is not the ordinary language used in conversation either. I suppose that Willie has probably heard me most when I've been talking legislation, not when I've been talking person to person, and therefore he might have some idea that my language is unduly highfalutin or something, but I don't. I suppose maybe I do use long words sometimes. I don't think that there's any resentment, though, among the Alaskan people against people that express themselves naturally in words they're accustomed to using, as long as they're sincere and honest about it.
Do you consider yourself intellectual?
Not in a class sense, Larry. I suppose I'm an intellectual in the sense that I make my living by the use of words. That's in that sense I am. Although, you know, intellectual has a lot of pejoratives. That is, it's used to meaning person that isn't practical. I consider myself practical. You know, I've met payroll, and I have worked with my hands, and I consider myself pragmatic. So whether I'm an intellectual or not is really, that's somebody else's label to apply to me. I believe in the value of thinking about what you're doing, And if that makes me an intellectual, then I suppose I have to wear that hat.
For the sake of this conversation, let's speculate that the primary is over and that you've won a... Let's speculate that you have won the primary and that you have the Democratic nomination for the U.S. House. What about a campaign against Don Young?
Well, as I say, if I file, my campaign would be against Don Young from the beginning. It'd be for me, but I mean, and try to bring to the people's attention the reasons why they should support me. But I don't believe in all sweetness and light, frankly. I think you should be in a position to point out where your approach to things contrasts with that of your opponent, and I will wage that kind of campaign. It'll be a forceful campaign.
Will you try to hang Watergate on Don Young?
If the shoe fits, then let him wear it. I've heard some people say, you know, the advice, John, if you're going to run, look what happened out there in Wisconsin and Ohio and so on, what you ought to run against the president. I don't feel that at all. I feel that Alaskans are primarily interested in representation for Alaska on an even-handed basis. And that doesn't involve test races against the president. I'll be running against Don Young, and I hope to convince the people that I'm a better representative if I do file than he is. But as far as the president goes, it's I think Don has certainly got some vulnerability in the knee-jerk support for the president he's given in every one of the White House's twists and turns on Watergate matters. And Don's going to have to do some wriggling to get out of that, but the issue will be that, not the president.
Is Don Young vulnerable in areas other than his seemingly tacit support of Nixon through Watergate?
Well, I believe he is, and I think that that will tend to be developed as the campaign goes along. The Don's a nice enough fellow, but you can't get away from the fact that he really was a accidental candidate and became an accidental congressman. And there is little in Don's prior record, frankly, that shows that he's has met major responsibilities in the past of the kind which would test him and show that he's qualified to meet the major tests that are before the country and before the state and the Congress.
I wonder, this is sort of a personal, personal from me to you question. I wonder when someone like yourself contemplates a candidacy for an office that will place him in Washington, I wonder, Terry Miller has just done it, he's going to run for the U.S. Senate. I wonder what your awareness is of national affairs. The incumbent always has the edge of looking with more than a modicum of disdain upon his opponent and, as being lacking in Washington affairs. But you've been back there many times.
Yes, Larry, I think over the last 3 years I've occasionally wondered, certainly my wife has wondered, whether I had taken up residence in Washington as it went through the process working with the governor and with the congressional delegation in getting the adoption of the Alaska Native Claims Settlement Act and then the pipeline legislation as well as litigation back there. I feel that I know what's going on national affairs level.
Our guest is John Havelock. Good evening, Beilein, you're on the air.
Those my radio.
I think he's turning his radio down. And that was an accident. I know who it was, so I'm sure that he'll call back. Let me know when you've got him. Okay, Sonny?
Right.
Let's take just a moment to talk about your speech to... Yes, Sonny?
Question from a caller.
Okay, let's do that, and then before we get into to Nixon and impeachment, Slim may be back.
The caller asked if you would comment on the bring home the bacon mentality of the Alaskan electorate.
I've heard that said about Alaskans, that it was strictly, it was a bring home the bacon mentality. I think that some of that is necessary. But I think that that is also that kind of thinking, regardless of its source of origin, belonged to an earlier time. In the years ahead, and that is starting, let's say, with 1970, bring home the bacon might be substituted in Alaska for protecting, representing, and articulating Alaska's interests in the, particularly in the energy economy situation, in our oil and gas and our pipelines. We're going to be one of the great producers of sources of energy for the United States in the next few years, and there is definitely a need to make sure that our interests are protected in that.
Good evening, Vilon. You're on the air.
Yeah, Larry. Sorry about that. I had the wrong radio on.
Oh.
When you said good evening, I turned it off, and it didn't go off. yeah, my comment was just what we need. Another lawyer to make laws for us, and I'll hang up and let him answer it on the air.
I'm in sympathy with the sentiment. Sometimes passing a new law is not what you need. And we certainly got a lot of laws on the books that definitely need revision. But you can't get away from the fact that the laws do need revising from time to time. We live in a changing world. And if you just forget about the law, you're going to find you're living under a system of antiquated laws.
I don't know why Slim would be exercised by that. I can't think of anything more appropriate for a lawmaker than a background in law.
It certainly doesn't hurt, but I can understand the feeling. The lawyers are not exactly, as you well know, Larry, the most popular professional class around.
And they're becoming less popular. They're popular with me because I find them articulate and great conversationalists and enjoy having them on the talk show. But law and order, somebody is... the attitude of the legal profession just isn't anywhere close to the attitude of the public today on law and order matters, and I want to touch on some of those a little bit later on. Sonny?
You have a caller on the line, Larry?
Okay. Good evening, Vilon. You're on the air.
Yeah, Larry, may I speak to Mr. Havelock, please?
Yes. Now, be nice.
Well, I'm always... What do you mean by that? I resent that.
Oh, don't bother, Glenn. You know how Larry is on
Mondays. Yeah, I know. Wishy-washy.
Hello?
Yes. You know, there's a couple of things that you got credit for doing while you were Attorney General that really didn't turn me on at all. One of them was when some little court back in Pennsylvania, I think, ruled that 30-day residency was all that was required. Right away, you made the ruling that that had to apply here in Alaska, and it's my understanding that that didn't have to be ruled 30-day. Another thing was the Marine Mammals Act. When Congress passed that, I assume that it was with your blessing. The Commissioner of Fish and Game doesn't usually do many things without that. It just didn't seem that we could comply quite rapidly enough to suit everybody that was involved in all of the marine mammal things. Now, my contention is that the Marine Mammals Act is absolutely unconstitutional. I don't think there's anything in the Constitution that gives the federal government the right to come up here and tell us how to run our game. Our Statehood Act gave us the right to manage our game, except now they take that away. They take 40 million acres away and give it back to the natives, and then they take away our right to manage our game, and I don't know what we got statehood for. Would you like to comment on those things?
Sure.
Okay, go ahead.
Let's start with the second one first.
The
Marine Mammals Act, I'm in sympathy with what you say. It certainly was not adopted upon my approval or with my support. The role, there appeared to be a pretty determined group at the national level that was going to pass this, and whatever could be done was simply a matter of attempting to give as good a case of why the effects of this act were going to be bad in Alaska as we could. That is, and I'm talking now to what you could do with the state government level, and the testimony that we took to the back to Washington on it was all to the effect that this was not desirable, would have a bad influence on the Alaska marine mammal situation, and that the state was quite capable of managing its own game, and that this was the best and constitutionally and historically the best way to run it.
Well, you could have cited the Omar Statehood Act to the enabling legislation that gave us the statehood, provided that we manage our game. See, I think you might have misunderstood what I said, or else you're not speaking to what I said. I'm not talking about before they passed the bill. I'm talking about afterward. As Attorney General and as a governor or anybody else in a position of trust here in the state, I would have liked to have seen a little backbone used and tell them, well, okay, you show me that you can do this. I don't believe they can do it. I think if we went to court and tested that Marine Mammals Act as it pertains to our game, up here managing our game, I think they wouldn't have a leg to stand on. But the point I was making was that it doesn't look to me like that you or the governor or who else has done what they could to maintain our rights as citizens of the state of Alaska. You couldn't hardly comply fast enough with these things that were not for the benefit of Alaska. They were detrimental. This 30-day residency is the awfulest thing that I ever heard of.
Well, let me turn to that one. You know, on your first point, I think I indicated that we did fight it beforehand. Now, after a law like that's passed, if somebody's going to test the constitutionality of it, then you have to wait for them to make an enforcement act, an act of enforcement, and then you test the constitutionality of it. And I would suppose that if a situation comes up that is favorable and that somebody feels that they've got a good test case to take up, that they would do it in that enforcement situation.
Well,
I don't ever remember getting any mail or call from the Fish and Game agencies or people or from the public asking me or no mail to the governor asking the governor that I can remember to initiate or attempt to initiate action to attack the constitutionality of the act from the beginning. And I frankly have never explored the idea of what you could do by way of litigation on that. Now, on the other one, let me do the 30-day residency thing, because that's one in which I sure did get a lot of mail. And I think the impression that I have is that everyone wants to execute the bearer of bad news. The opinion that you're referring to was in fact a Supreme Court opinion, Supreme Court of the United States, not a Pennsylvania law, and I gave a ruling that after reading the opinion carefully that it applied to Alaska, even though Alaska may not have been named as one of the states in the ruling that it was. I went to the National Association Attorney General's Conference and found that about six or seven attorney generals had so ruled as I had at approximately the same time. Others had said, well, okay, that's what the Constitution says, but let's make them enforce it here in this state, and because of the political heat that was involved. It's not just Alaska, but the whole country had problems with that residency issue. I felt that it was my duty as the state's chief law enforcement officer to tell the people what the Supreme Court had said the Constitution was, even though I might get some heat for it. And I was right, and there's no question on that point today.
Well, my point is that maybe that was right. I still don't think that it was right, because the decision didn't even apply to the situation here in Alaska. It was some little deal. I've forgotten now exactly what it was, but I did read up on it at the time, and I don't profess to be any lawyer, but it just seemed to me that you just couldn't do it fast enough to comply with that, to give all of these 30-day residents the voting right here in Alaska. And I realize that the majority of that type of people that I'm speaking of that were franchised to vote up here weren't going to vote for the Republicans. There's no question about that. They were mostly all in the other side of the fence. You may have sincerely believed that, but it certainly wasn't a bad move politically as far as the votes were concerned. Now, I don't want to give the impression that I think Jim Brooks is any different than you are, the Commissioner of Fish and Game. He worked for the Fish and Wildlife Service, and I don't think his allegiance is here in the United in Alaska at all. I think it's with the federal government that wants to take over the management of our game up here. And if we had a governor down there that had a backbone, we would be challenging that Marine Mammals Act right now. But, man, we're just complying right down the line with it. We're not giving them a chance to prove that they have that they can do it. We haven't given them anything in the world that they could, so we could go to court with it. We've just complied right down the line.
Okay, you made your point.
Thank you.
Have a good week.
Thank you.
Night. Bye. Any more comment?
I think I more or less gave my position on it, Larry. The residency thing should be, it's what should be said in addition maybe is that, as I said at the time, you still have to be a bona fide resident, and even for the 30 days, that is, summer tourists, people that drop in and have residences somewhere else, and other temporary people coming up temporarily, are not entitled to vote, were not then and are not now. And I did at that time recommend a number of changes to the legislature, methods for tightening up on the enforcement of the residency situation, although my recollection is that few, if any, were adopted.
We have a local hire law in Alaska. How legal is it as it presently stands? Can it be beaten?
Larry, since I left the Attorney General's office, my understanding is that the Supreme Court of Alaska ruled against a local hire law as to state employment. There has yet to be any test of the preferential hire as it applies to contracts, and I think in this situation you can easily take the position that each situation must be tested on its own merits and see what happens.
Would I be right in I've said that it's very vulnerable in court? It probably is, isn't it?
Well, it's certainly a subject of litigation. Yeah, there's a good argument against it, and the arguments for it and from a constitutional basis are not necessarily that strong. If you're just sort of betting on which way it would go, you'd have to say that it's no better than even.
We'll learn that probably over the next year. Our guest is John Havelock. You spoke to the Fairbanks Kiwanis Club today, and you spoke of impeachment. What were some of your points?
Well, Larry, the main point I wanted to make was that impeachment is a quite different process than the criminal justice process. Impeachment involves only the removing of a man from an office. It doesn't involve him going to jail. It doesn't involve any fine or loss of property. The only interest at stake is the interest of the people in the office of the presidency itself. No man has a right to that office. It's the people's office, and they determine. And the much of the controversy that has arisen in the last, has been going on the last few weeks about discovery, the scope of discovery, and so on, has been based upon drawing an analogy with a criminal law and treating the president as a defendant in a criminal proceeding. And all those procedural protections which the president has been evoking may be applicable in a criminal proceeding, but are not necessarily at all applicable in an impeachment. The how that impeachment works out, of course, is in some ways just a test of power between the presidency on the one hand and the legislative body on the other, the Congress.
I thought that the Senate, in order to impeach, would have to find the president guilty of high crimes and misdemeanors and so forth. I thought that made the analogies that this was a kind of criminal proceeding fit.
Well, in the way that there is a term, high crimes and misdemeanors, in the constitutional provision, but this is not the term of art that where we use misdemeanors and felonies today. It means something different. It means misconduct in general. And I think that Gerry Ford, you know, when he was a member of the Congress, when he was asked then what was an impeachable offense, he said, it's whatever the Congress chooses to make it. And I think that's a correct interpretation of the Constitution. It's misconduct.
Gerry Ford was, does it still sounds okay now? I had a little mic trouble. Gerry Ford, I point out, can speak all he wants to today about impeachment, you know, and how he doesn't believe President Nixon should be impeached, and how he doesn't really like impeachment, but if one recalls, it was Gerry Ford who wanted to impeach Justice Bill Douglas because he married a young girl. And I'm not fond of anybody who wants to impeach someone for marrying a young girl. And Gerry Ford wanted to impeach Bill Douglas again when it's found out that he was getting $12,000 or had $12,000 from an eleemosynary organization. So Gerry Ford had impeachment on the mind a few years ago when it came to Bill Douglas, and he just can't seem to grasp it now. Sonny, you take it for just a moment.
And now, piping hot and hot to trot, the man from Uncle's presents the Great Pizza Deliverance. Fast and fantastic pizza deliverance right to your door, your business lunch at your guard post on Fort Wainwright, your desk on the campus of the U of A, or wherever the hungry's corny you within the city limits of Fairbanks. Call 452-1636 right now and order up a big cheesy one. 452-1636, and the man from Uncle's will be there in a streak. A flash. $1 delivery charge. The pizza box you get free. Uncle's.
452-1636.
You're listening to Beeline. Our Beeline number is 452-2468, 452-2468. Larry?
Thank you, Sonny. Our guest tomorrow night will be Dr. Ned Wagner. He's a psychologist with the University of Washington. He'll be in town for a workshop on sexuality, and that will be our topic at 6:45 tomorrow night on Beeline. And coming up Wednesday night, Fairbanks attorney Steve Cooper returns to the show for a continuation of his comments on the court system. Our guest this evening, John Havelock, former Attorney General of the state of Alaska, who's expected to make an announcement on Thursday, possibly to announce his candidacy for a statewide office. And in your comments today to the Fairbanks Kiwanis Club about impeachment and what it means, your interpretations of it, pursuing that somewhat further, people who are tending to defend Nixon, plus Nixon himself, say that a president shouldn't serve at the pleasure of the polls, meaning that if Nixon, who is presently enjoying 25%, one in four say that he's doing an adequate job as president, that when the sentiment of the country is such that the people are down on you, the majority of them are down on you, that shouldn't be cause for one to resign. And similarly, if we're talking about Gerry Ford's old definition of impeachability, the U.S. House shouldn't really impeach the president, which is to say indict him, just simply because the members of the Congress are down on him. Would you tend to agree with this?
I suppose I don't really, and all that is, that's a conventional wisdom now, but I would suppose that I believe that although it's, you certainly don't want the president to be bumped out on sort of casual fluctuations in his standing in the polls, still, our national leadership depends upon the support of the people in order to be effective government. And to take the extreme case, supposing the polls showed him registering at zero, what kind of a government do you have? If you have a situation where the president completely lacks the confidence of some 70 or 80% of the people over matters that are really deep-seated and not just a momentary reaction to some superficial factor in political life, I'm not sure that it is desirable for him to continue in office under those circumstances. I would hate, for instance, supposing you had a president who became increasingly unpopular because of his involvement in a foreign war on his own initiative. It would seem to me that rather than see him take us the last step into some sort of total holocaust with 90% of the people opposing him, that that lack of popularity should be reflected in an impeachment proceeding. Now, as far as the definition goes of an impeachable offense, sure, there are some limitations. That is, I don't think you want to move to a purely a parliamentary system where the president serves at the pleasure of the Congress. But there are many safeguards written in now that assure that that won't happen. But fundamentally, it is the president should, to some extent, serve at the pleasure of the people. And if the definition that the House will be describing, you see, they, as you know, they're going to be defining the impeachment, and then it goes to the Senate for a trial on the charges brought and the facts to see whether the facts match up with them. Now, whatever the charges are that are brought, they would have to be of such a nature that if proven, that the public would overwhelmingly agree that the person should be thrown out of office if they are proven correctly, and that's the basis upon which the Senate would make a trial. So, and I don't think the people would tolerate a frivolous definition of an impeachable offense as that impeachment is voted by the House.
Just one other question about this, and our guest is John Havelock. The president has lied to us repeatedly, and he seems to imply, at least I infer from what he says, that he lies to us for our own good. And we can start with the bombing of Cambodia and go down a list of them. Do you believe that a president should be required to tell the people the truth?
That's pretty loaded, Larry. I don't really have any alternative than to say, yes, of course he should tell us the truth. And it's too bad that, and it's not just Mr. Nixon alone.
On both the big things and the little things?
Too bad that he's gotten into that habit, that frame has occurred. And I think it's incumbent, you know, it's an ethical responsibility of a human being to tell the truth. I suppose there are some kinds of truths you don't tell, you know, out of kindness to the person involved, but that doesn't really apply to the political scene.
Whether it's required or should be required for the president to tell the truth or not, turn it around, do you believe the president should be impeached for lying to the people? You know, sometimes you just don't have to comment, and therefore you haven't committed yourself to either the truth or the lie. The president has commented, has committed himself to the lie. Is the lying to the American public impeachable?
Well, I think that certainly, Larry, I think that being dishonest with the public, and I'm not prejudging quite the way you have whether the president has lied and been lying, that's a matter that's subject to proof and so on.
Oh, he's proved it.
But, I had never heard the president say that he'd been lying lately. But I certainly think that if it is certainly a form of misconduct that is an impeachable offense, yes.
Well, just pursuing that a moment, he did in fact tell us that he was not bombing Cambodia, did he not? And then he did, in fact, tell us that he was bombing Cambodia. Now, in the first instance, was he lying?
Larry, you're putting me in a funny position of defending the president, and I don't really have, without having the quotes in front of me, I'd be hard-pressed to examine it. I really would want to see the quotes.
Good evening, Beeline. You're on the air.
Larry, I'd like to ask your guest a couple of questions.
Certainly.
Go ahead.
Mr. Havelock?
Yes, sir.
You just answered a question of Larry's that you thought that the president should tell the truth. The president has to take an oath of office, doesn't he, when he's admitted?
Sir, all of us do. It's the same oath that I took when I became Attorney General.
Did you take the oath of office to uphold the Constitution of the United States?
I did, sir.
Did you tell all the people all the truth, that every decision that you made while you were in office?
To the best of my belief and knowledge, yes.
Well,
I'm not saying I'm above making a mistake, sir, but I always felt I was being honest.
Don't your mistakes kind of benefit the people that you're trying to protect?
Are you going to bring your lawsuit into this?
Larry, We're fighting this damn thing, and Havelock made a decision against me to try to get a special prosecutor, and I want to know why. And I'm trying to get to the people, and maybe in a few days we'll give you some information on the Sheriff's Posse Comitatus that will bring this about.
Now, you want to know what from Mr. Havelock?
I want to know why he makes the decision to protect the guilty. And in this particular case, I was asking for a special prosecutor that I would hire, pay him myself, I've already paid him, to prosecute a guilty man, and Havelock said he couldn't do it.
Okay, I'll ask him why.
All right.
Okay.
That's Rod Wolf, and he, and it has to do with his suit with, golly, what's his name? I forget now. In regard to the Arctic Bowl, you know, and his request for a special prosecutor of that case. What's his name? Begins with Z. Doesn't it?
I don't remember. I have some dim recollection of this matter. I mean, I don't know. It's not the only time anybody's ever asked for a special prosecutor.
It's Paul Zandifer.
Paul Zandifer, yes. And incidentally, I'm not trying to protect you from any question. Yeah. I've just told Rod that I'm not going to try his case much more on this show.
Yes, I'll just say in general what my feelings about private prosecutors. I think that it's a disservice to the criminal law generally and to respect for the law to put out prosecutions under the criminal law for hire in aid of what are private lawsuits. And for that reason, I have disapproved of a number of requests for sort of special prosecutors to help people in private litigation by laying a criminal case on side by side. There are some occasions where a special prosecutor is called for, but those are few and far between.
What if the civil suit is brought to a conclusion and the defendant loses? Do you examine it for criminal prosecution at that point?
Well, no, I think that the district attorney's responsibility is to assess any given situation to determine whether it is primarily a criminal case or a civil case. If he determines it's primarily criminal, then he would bring criminal proceedings regardless of whether there was a civil action pending.
Well, then, is your answer to Rod that his suit was examined and that you didn't feel there was a criminal case there?
Well, frankly, I don't know at this point whether this was one where, in fact, a criminal case was brought or whether it was one that was refused by the DA. Sometimes I've been asked to appoint a special prosecutor when we have, in fact, initiated a criminal action, and then the individual involved feels so, you know, strongly about it that he would like to get into the private enforcement game himself and, you know, add on more prosecutors to strengthen the criminal prosecution's hand. I think you're going to lose control of the whole system, though, if you allow those sort of private vendettas to take over the public, even-handed responsibility of the district attorney to perform his job.
In regard to Rod's case, we told Rod to cool it as far as this show was concerned. We've told him that in the past. However, we've also told him that we will cover that case fully in our newscasts, and we have, and we're the only media in Fairbanks that has, and we'll report exactly what happens with that case, as Rod knows we have, and we'll continue to do, and let the public know the outcome of it. Yes, Sonny.
A caller asked Mr. Havelock how you feel about restoring capital punishment, and also for what crimes in particular. And the caller also wanted your comments on the light sentencing that comes out of the court system.
Now, let me take the capital punishment issue first. As you know, there has not been capital punishment in effect in this state since, I believe, 1947. I don't have any objection in principle to capital punishment myself. I do believe, however, that before you leap into something like that, you ought to examine it very carefully in terms of its effects. And this sudden flurry in the legislature where after a full term and a half gone, suddenly somebody leaps in and with a death penalty statute does not show that kind of a carefully considered approach to the issue, which I think is called for when you're dealing with something as entitled to respect as life itself. The as far as the consequences...
May I toss one in here? The State House today passed a bill calling for a mandatory life sentence without parole for some particularly heinous crimes. What do you feel about, what's your feeling about mandatory life sentencing?
Well, it's a, it can be a pretty expensive thing, but if there, you know, if a majority of the people feel that that's desirable, just as, and if, here's, let me say this, the problem that relates to it, I have no problem with mandatory life or for certain classes of offenses, provided that people don't change their mind later. You know, it's one way you feel now, but how are you going to feel in 10 years when that person is, or 20 years or 30 years, the person's there? The and what are the public attitudes going to be? Here's the problem with the, a practical problem with the capital punishment that may apply also to mandatory life sentences is the, if the majority of the people don't agree with that, you're never going to get a conviction. And I'd hate to take in a serious murder charge and find that I couldn't get a conviction as a prosecutor because a large part of the general public who is going to be reflected on that jury don't believe in life in those punishments, and the result of which is that I get an acquittal, and the worst thing that possibly happens is you've got a killer who goes free on the streets right there.
That's I guess I'm confused. That's not a majority vote on that, is it? Isn't it?
No, it's all you need is one person on that jury that doesn't believe in capital punishment, and that one person may wipe you out on the conviction.
Well, that's what I mean. The jury has to be unanimous, doesn't it?
That's right, on its conviction.
Right, and this is a point that's rarely made. I oppose the death penalty for any number of reasons, not the least of which is that you have to take into account what the jury will convict for, and that's not always done by the public. However, the next one, I think, is our important question. The caller is suggesting that the judges are lenient in sentencing. Do you agree or disagree?
We aren't really going to know until we get some statistics. You can't judge these questions and on emotions. Well, if you have statistics, then they're good. But let me say give you my general impression from the data that we gathered previously is that they're probably, and this is something I might add in talking with other law enforcement people that I've come to the conclusion that frequently a short, swift shot is desirable in the interest of justice and may act as a substantial deterrent. And we probably do not send enough people to jail for short sentences. The deterrent effect tends to slide off. The longer the sentence, the less significant the deterrent effect is. But when you've got a situation where, you know, a burglar or whatever feels that he's got a good chance, even before he commits the crime, of getting a suspended sentence and never having to do a day in jail, then you do lose a lot of deterrent effect. And in a sense, what I would like to see, not through the adoption of laws, but through the judges stiffening up, getting more what you might call judicially imposed mandatory minimum sentences on time serving, whether it's 30 days or 10 days or whatever. And with some kids, just a couple of days in jail may change their whole life favorably, but where you let them out on parole you know, without their ever spending any time behind bars, they get into a repeater habit. They think they can get away with it.
John, I have a statistical research project of the Alaska court system conducted in part by the Law Enforcement Assistance Administration that was published in December of 1973. We also have another document here that was prepared at the request of a city councilman by Police Chief Bob Sundberg, which he, as I understand it, authenticated with the courts. Both are statistical surveys, one for the state, one for Fairbanks. And it's appalling. The story is clear. It's not subject to any other interpretation than that our courts are exceedingly lenient. We've just finished a series of reports on the one prepared by Sundberg, and it reads unbelievably. Let me just toss this one out. picked it sort of at random here as we were talking. One individual had been arrested 60 times. Now, we're talking about an assault. This was on the tube tonight in our crime report series. One individual had been arrested 60 times since 1948, mostly for alcohol-related offenses. He pled guilty. This is talking about assault and battery. In district court, Judge Mary Alice Miller sentenced him to 5 days in jail with all five suspended on 6 months' good behavior. Now, my question to Judge Miller is, what's the likelihood that a person who's been arrested 60 times has any good behavior? That's ludicrous, isn't it? We have case after case after case, page after page after page of the same kind of sentencing that's ludicrous. We have, in one assault incident, the victim was medically dead when taken to the Fairbanks Memorial Hospital. He had been stabbed 8 times and received 5 pints of blood in the emergency room, etc. The assault was the result of a street fight. The individual charged with that assault had no prior arrest record. He pled no contest to a reduced charge of carrying a concealed weapon, and he received a $100 fine. This has been that case I recall from Blanchfield Alley, and it was just, you know, just remarkable. Now, if these were isolated cases, John, that I mentioned, then it would just be pointing out the conservative or hard right view and so forth. But these are not isolated cases. Mm-hmm. I can go into this statistical research project and have the Alaska court system, and this is the rule that doesn't make sense.
Mm-hmm. Well, I'd be inclined to agree with you, Larry, from what you say. I wasn't familiar with these statistics. Of course, they came out a couple of months after I left, but if you may well be right that this reflects a laxness as far as from the sentencing problem.
Here's one, and I'm going to make a point with this. One individual had 75 arrests since 1962. He pled guilty. This is to assault and battery. And Judge Robson issued an order withholding sentence and directing him to go to API for participation in the alcoholism program, and he was arrested twice more after that in 1973. If the courts don't know what to do with these people, then shouldn't the courts, or if not the courts, who, suggest to the public what we should do about it? Mm-hmm. Meaning, instead of Judge Miller saying, after 60 arrests of this fellow, I'm going to let you back out in the streets and suspend your sentence on condition of good behavior, when she must fully well know that he's not going to behave, does she lack alternatives? And if she lacks alternatives, rather than the courts defending themselves in the light of this, you know, from public criticism,
yeah.
How about the court suggesting what should be done?
Uh-huh. Well, I really don't know what the courts have or have not suggested. Certainly with you're talking about anybody who's been arrested 60 or 70 times, they are chronic alcoholics, and you really need a program for them of some kind that takes them out of circulation for some period of time. I don't have any answers to that, Larry. If I did, then even if public officers did generally, then I suspect that we would have found a solution.
Good evening, Beeline. You're on the air.
Hello, Harry. Getting along, Larry. Come on to a plate.
Hi, Ro.
Got any feedback? I mean, from my radio.
Yes, just a little.
Okay, let me cut it down.
I think he dropped the phone.
I think a lot of the questions you're putting to John are probably my questions. And first of all, I didn't know John was going to be here tonight. It's good to hear him. I think that the news covered him quite well today on impeachment and explained it from a viewpoint so that laymen can understand what impeachment actually is. But you're talking about some of the problems connected with law enforcement, which were my problems before I left the district attorney's office. And I think you misconstrue a number of the points there. You're talking about so-and-so was arrested so many times. You're not talking about whether there were convictions. You're saying someone was arrested for assault and battery, and he had 30 or 40 arrests. They may have been for drunken public or whatever. It had nothing to do with assault, and you're criticizing the courts for it, and I'm really wondering what your object is. I have not been furnished with a copy of the report.
My point is this, Ro. Of course, arrests aren't convictions.
And, of course, many of these, as we say, mostly for alcohol-related offenses. This one individual that we mentioned, 60, with the 60 arrests, 60 arrests on his rap sheet, among them were assault and battery that he committed while drunk, and he pled guilty to this assault and battery and was sentenced to 5 days with them all suspended on the condition of his good behavior. My point is quite simply this, that surely the judge recognizes in this individual that he's going to go out and get drunk again, doesn't she?
Perhaps so. I'm not intending
that. And that when drunk, he's capable of assaulting and battering someone.
I'm not trying to impose my judgment on that of court, but on the other hand,
well,
if a person has been arrested for 50 times for drunk in public and once for assault and battery, is this indicative of an aggressive type behavior on an individual? I mean, you have to look at each individual case, Larry. That's what I was getting at.
Right, and this is what I thought was the ace in the hole for the court system prior to reading these two reports, that the critics of the courts were pulling out isolated incidents. They aren't. They're pulling out the rule rather than the exception. And I am making a value judgment that I believe the courts are far too lenient.
That perhaps, I'm not criticizing what your judgment may be. I mean, that's beside the point. What I'm saying is, how many arrests and convictions has this particular person had for an aggressive type behavior like assault and battery, other than being drunk in a bar, drunk on a street, or something like that? I'm talking about the individual assessment of each case of aggravated type behavior.
I'll tell you what, I think that I can find that, but I'd like to do it while John was talking. So let me try and find it during the remainder of the show, and we'll go on.
Well, okay. Thank you, John.
All right.
We'll see you,
Larry. Thank you, Larry.
Would you care to comment further on that? I've commented enough, except perhaps finding this thing for Roe.
Well, your comment, Larry, was that society doesn't seem to have any adequate solution to the chronic alcoholic. And as I say, the person who has been arrested 60 or 70 times is, and I hope you aren't going to quote and refer to him by name on the program, Ray, but anybody in that category has to be pretty much of a stumble bum.
This question might fit in here then. A caller asked, should you decide to file and run for office, what would you attempt to do in Washington to help our state's alcoholism problem, to help solve our alcoholism problem?
I would have to admit at this point that I am not familiar with any existing federal support for alcohol programs exist. I've certainly seen that, and if there are no such programs, and I will establish that, then certainly additional support in that area is necessary. I do feel I'm a strong supporter of the Law Enforcement Assistance Administration program. My recollection is that the drug offenses and alcohol offenses were separated off from that a few years ago, and federal money in those areas does not go to the law enforcement field, but goes to health and social services on a match.
Sonny, is my mic okay?
Yes, it's fine.
Before we go on, even at risk of missing the 8 o'clock news, I found this fellow with 60 prior arrests, and drunk and disorderly, 7 days, second degree murder, no disposition, drunk, $25 bail forfeited, drunk and disorderly, bail forfeited, drunk, $40 in 15 days, with 15 days suspended, grand larceny, 2 counts, 1 year and 1 day each count, larceny, obtaining money by false pretenses, 1 year, 1 day, drunk, dismissed, drunk, 5 days, disorderly conduct, 6 months and $6 fine, stabbing with intent to wound, 1 year, 1 day, with 7 months suspended, drunk, 10 days suspended, assault and battery, dismissed, lack of prosecution, disorderly conduct, 20 days. Breaking and entering, 2 years or 13 months suspended. Larceny included in count one of sentence. Disorderly conduct, 2 counts, 10 days each count. Disorderly conduct, 30 days. Disorderly conduct, 20 days. Assault and battery, 18 months. Larceny from a person included in count one sentence. Disorderly conduct, $25 fine. Vagrancy, 5 days suspended. Disorderly conduct, 10 days. Drunk, vagrancy, burglary, carrying concealed weapon, vagrancy, rioting, disorderly conduct, drunk in public, receiving stolen property, assault and battery, parole revocation.
493 days remaining to be served. Drunk, 5 days suspended. Disorderly conduct with 10 days suspended. Drunk, disorderly conduct, burglary in a dwelling, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And where's his good behavior? And it's not all just being drunk in public. And this is the point of our series. And doesn't it make one stop and think? And this is the person who was had 5 days sentenced on a guilty plea and 5 days suspended pending good behavior.
I think what the good behavior means, Larry, is if I'm not incorrect, is that if he makes a mistake in those 5 days, he goes back in the pokey, does it not?
Well, I'm sure that's what it means,
yeah.
John, but does it make any sense?
Well, there's no habitual criminal count on misdemeanors. Maybe you can argue that there is if you feel that the... And, you know, if the authorities felt in examining this man's record... How old is he, incidentally, at this time?
I don't know.
I would guess with a record like that and the time he spent in jail, he must be an elderly person, I would imagine.
Well, we have ones worse than this. It just happens to be the one that I read here.
But I don't know what, you know, maybe the solution is that... A person like that is evidently pretty well institutionalized anyway, spends most of his life. Maybe the answer is never to let him out.
Well, my point is, why must we defend the courts in the light of that kind of fact? Why don't the courts try to decide what, you know, the right thing? Why don't we try to help the courts? I don't want to just abuse the courts, but I don't like this seemingly fanatical defense of the courts from people like myself who are making these points.
Sure.
Something's wrong.
It's hard to do anything. Now, what would happen, Larry, supposing that the judge had given that person 30 days, you know, and then the person is then let out again? Now, what? I suppose there's an extra 25 days there where the public has been protected. Unless you can find some long-term institutionalization that you can impose, you're in a difficult position to know what to do.
That's precisely my point through almost all of this, that I think the judiciary is in a difficult, the district courts and the superior courts are in a difficult position to know what to do. And therefore, I think we should address ourselves to what to do. But what we are doing in many instances clearly is not right. That's my point. John, do you have a parting thought for us on anything?
Well, we talked about... One thing we didn't get to was national or international affairs, and I think I might make one comment on my views about international matters as they affect the role of the Arab states in the energy crisis. There was a, earlier in American history, there was a situation where the French were taking over American shipping on the high seas and asking for payments for the return of these vessels. And our Secretary of State at the time, rather than paying this, made a famous statement come down in history that the United States is willing to pay millions for defense, but not 1 cent for tribute. And I feel that in the monopoly situation with regard to Middle Eastern oil that we're now in on a national level, that we are in somewhat of the same position. The prices are being administered by the Arab states. It costs simply by administered, I mean it costs exactly whatever they lay out as the tariff. And I think this means that if, as a moment of national policy for our country, that we should spend millions as necessary to become energy self-sufficient rather than being in a position of being blackmailed by Arab nations in the future.
John, we want to thank you very much for being our guest this evening. I have a loose mic cord, I think. Thank
could
you
be
very
your,
much,
could
Sonny.
Be your throat, Larry.
Yes, it may be. As for now, enough.
You've presented Monday through Friday at this time on KFRB Radio as a production of the Broadcast Center. This is Sonny Carpenter, and I invite you to join us again tomorrow night for more live, spontaneous conversation on Beeline.
Just as you do.